I'm Afshin Ratansi, and we're going underground on British Armed Forces Day. And in this special edition, we're joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Cy Hirsch, who exposed NATO nation war crimes of the military-industrial complex. From Abu Ghraib prison in the Anglo-American war in Iraq to the My Lai massacre, Cy Hirsch has exerted a damning skepticism of the official line. Did the Syrian government really use chemical weapons? What was the truth behind the Osama bin Laden assassination? What connects NATO nations to ISIS, Daesh, and Al-Qaeda? And should we believe Theresa May about the poisoning of the Skripals in England? His new book, Reporter, a Memoir, is out now. Cy, thanks so much for coming back on Going Underground. Why you rather than Dick Cheney? I thought you were writing a book on Dick Cheney.
It's a source issue. I mean, what happened is, Obama, in the Obama years, he tightened down very much on leaks and dissent, and particularly in the intelligence community. He put a CIA guy in jail. There were people in the White House, somebody who was jailed also privately without public disclosure. There was a sense that Obama really didn't like leaks. And so I had done a book on Cheney. I'd written a lot about Cheney for The New Yorker during, after 9/11. And there was a story, a book to write. And when I began giving chapters to people involved, they said the appropriate, it just couldn't be published because they would get in trouble. They're professional intelligence people and military people. The ones I deal with, they take an oath of office to the Constitution and not to any particular president. So I just couldn't publish the book and put them in jeopardy. It would put them in jeopardy. It would make it almost impossible for me. The trick about me is that I don't give up people. I mean, people, they don't go after my people. They don't know who they are. I put nothing in a computer. I write all my interviews in longhand. And so I just felt if I published stuff over their opposition and they got prosecuted, I would A, not sleep at night, and B, also not be able to do the kind of reporting I'm still doing.
If anyone reading this memoir about so much military action of one kind or another, they shouldn't be ignorant of the fact that I think you said recently that we're at war, or the United States is at war in 76 countries now, let alone the wars you chronicle in this.
What I said was that there's 76 places in the world where the Americans are involved with kinetically with weapons. And it was based on actually a public study done by an institute at Brown University called the Watson Institute. And knowing some of the people involved with the study, it's there's a lot of stuff that we have a big special forces community that are active, particularly in Africa and a lot of places. I think the public knows very little about it. I don't think my president has been briefed on any of it. I don't think he's not interested in it, or he doesn't know about it. I know there's concern about some people in the military and high up in the military and of my government in Washington about what are these guys doing? Who's in control? There's a lack of control among the special forces. They've just gotten, and many of them are driven with the idea that they are in a crusade, that they're the Knights of Malta fighting the infidels in the 14th century or 13th century. I mean, it's really crazy stuff. And so I don't think, when I hear the military, the Special Operations Command say about Mali, here's what happened, four guys died, how? I'm sorry, I just think there's probably much more to the story. I think there's much more to our presence there. But it's very hard to get to that stuff.
Lots of opportunities for reporters, maybe. Were you thinking in any way that this memoir, already been reviewed quite widely, favorably, helps defending you from some quite extraordinary ad hominem attacks on your recent reporting?
No, the only thing that happened in my recent reporting is, it was fine when Bush and Cheney, when Dick Cheney and George Bush were in charge, but when Obama came in, he was the white knight, if you will, or the black knight, I guess, African-American, and it just changed. The editors just, that's the way it is. The stories that would have been fine in the days of Bush and Cheney suddenly were, not getting published, and people were complaining that all of a sudden they're complaining about anonymous sources, as if every day in the New York Times you can't pick up the newspaper and find the lead story based on anonymous sources. It's just part of our business. You can't name people, and particularly the stuff I do. But when I first did the My Lai story, the My Lai massacre story in 1969, the first thing I remember, there was a poll from the University of Minnesota. 54% of the people didn't believe it, and 46. And among my peers, 80% didn't believe it.
You might have to expand on the My Lai story because it's not on any British curriculum, as stated. I'm not sure in the United States.
You know how it is. It's when I was growing up, I was born in 1937. By the time I got into my 20s and 30s, the World War I, oh my God, the only thing I knew about World War I is Fields of Poppies and Hemingway novels. So it's not surprising to me that the generation today doesn't know what happened. Realize Vietnam has disappeared in America pretty, you know, it wasn't a good war for us. I'm sure it's still, there's still five pages in textbooks, but there was a period when universities all had special courses on the war, but that was 20, 30 years ago. You and I, we're too old, buddy. We're old people.
I'm much younger.
Yeah, but you, you know, look, I, no gray hair, but you must hint it.
But if I don't, but if we go, well, since you mentioned it, the My Lai massacre still resonates, certainly amongst journalists, maybe historians of Vietnam. You tell in this book the story of trying to find sources and witnesses. Just describe what you go into there.
Well, I just got a tip about it. You know, I covered, it's not as if I came from nothing. I've been a police reporter in Chicago. And let me tell you about being a police reporter in 1960 or 61 in Chicago. It was, you learned a couple of things. You learned all about the weakness. As a, my first job, I was a copy boy working for a news agency that covered crime and police stations. And so what I learned was, you could do anything you want as a reporter. It was great fun. You're on the street, you're reporting about fires and murders. But if a cop kills a black person, that's off the books. You don't, you know, no matter what, your word's not going to be taken. And if you ever get into the police relationship with the mafia in Chicago, you know, this is Sam Giancana, some of those names, some of your people know the famous mafiosos. You could see find some guy in the street with 14 bullets in him in a downtown area where there's clubs controlled by the mob. And it would be reported as an automobile accident. And so I learned right away that there was tyranny in the world, that there were things you couldn't do. There was self-censorship to an astonishing degree. I had a great time. I learned a lot about, I covered fires. I learned more about racism than I thought I would. But I also knew there was, as I say, tyranny. There were certain things you could not get. The Chicago Police Department was operating in a world on its own. Things have changed a lot since then. But what a lesson. And that was in 60, 61. I went in the Army. I worked for United Press International. I covered a legislature in Pierce, South Dakota, town of 10,000. I was a Chicago kid, never lived in a small city. I then worked in Chicago and I was sent to Washington, covered the war from the Pentagon, learned to hate the war. But the point I'm making is by the time I got to the My Lai story, I'd been in the business 8 or 9 years. And so when I got a tip about somebody shooting up a village, you've got to read before you write. So I was a nut about watching, reading the New York Times coverage of the war. And then I read the French journalists and Bernard Fall. There was a couple of wonderful French journalists who wrote about the fall of France in DMB and Fou in 1954. And so I read a lot. And so the Bertrand Russell Tribunal was very important. Although everybody in America said Bertrand Russell's, he hates America, he's 94, but it was an incredible document. There was testimony from American soldiers about shooting up villages like crazy in 65, very early. So when I got a tip about My Lai, I dropped whatever else I was doing and I thought I could do it. But I thought, I heard that some GI went crazy and shot up 75 people. And that sounded like something that could happen. What they did in the war early on is we would go into villages, American units, a company would go in on a raid and find nobody there. And the way it worked is we always thought the Viet Cong, our enemy, the North Vietnamese, they were farmers by day and guerrillas at night. So we go early in the morning and catch them in bed after a night of being a guerrilla. I don't know what the craziness was. Women and children. So after enough of those raids, you would get frustrated. And sometimes the officers would say, okay, guys, I know you're all angry. Everybody can have a mad moment in this village. The tank gunner with his missiles and the machine gun, you can shoot the villages up. So that was going on. To let the guys get off, if you will. They'd so be happy. So they'd shoot up villages, and that's what I thought they were talking about. And then I got into the story, and at the same time as I'm writing about the fact these people killed 567 people, something like that, an innocent people. They were a company that had been in the war for about 3 months. The kids knew nothing about the Vietnam or the culture, and they were proportionally more Hispanics and blacks than in the population, and poor farm kids, really white kids. McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, had lowered the standard by 67 and 68. He wanted no more. There was a draft that presumably would take very well-educated, middle-class white people. He didn't want them in the war because they would come home and talk and be articulate about it. And the senator who ran against Lyndon Johnson, Eugene McCarthy, used to talk brilliantly about McNamara wanted to change the color of the corpses. But in this village, they were briefed, this company that had seen no enemy, they had been sniped at, and they'd fallen into pits with sticks full of poison. They'd lost about 20 or 30 people of their 100, and they wanted payback. And they were told by a CIA official, a contract employee, bad intelligence, tomorrow you're going to go into a village and you're going to see the enemy there. So they got ready to go, to their credit, to kill and be killed for America, right? They hadn't seen no combat, really. And they fly in and there's nothing there. Woman making 550, 60 men, woman, no men, old men, women, children. And they began to round them up and execute them. What I couldn't write about was they did things like throwing up babies and catching them alive on bayonets. I mean, and raping like crazy. I had so much trouble with that story because I didn't know what I was getting into when I first started it. And the horror and a shame I felt for my country and for my soldiers. I've been in the army. I didn't. The army I was in was a peace army. The idea that the guys I served with would do this kind of stuff. And so in a way, the kids who did, it was mostly the white kids, the Hispanics and the African-Americans. No way, man. This is, let the Ofe's, the whites, let them do it. This isn't for us. And the next day they all wore armbands, some of the minorities, and they were ordered to take them off. They put black armbands on, trying to separate themselves from the white kids who'd done the shooting. Anyway, it's just a mess. It was a great story.
But in the book, you don't blame those soldiers.
No, how can you? They weren't told anything about the society. They were told they were communists. They're out to kill us. And they couldn't figure out these kids. We're not talking about the creme de la creme of America. These are the lower working class kids. McNamara lowered the standards. Normally, they wouldn't be bright enough for having, well, not about brains, about education. They wouldn't be getting into the army. So what did they know? One of the problems they had is, my God, these people didn't have refrigerators. I mean, I talked to 40 or 50 of them before I wrote my, after I wrote a book about this afterwards. And I spent 6-8 months just flying around America talking to the kids. Some slammed the doors, some didn't talk to me, but many did. And they're pouring out their heart. They had a problem in Vietnamese society when they would evacuate. One of the things we did in the war was we would remove families from their lands that had been ancestral fields for their protection. It was called, and move them into what we called fortified hamlets, which enabled us to declare the areas that they cleared free fire zones. You could shoot at anything. And when they had villages there with people, you could do it. So we would evacuate them and say it's for their good and put them in the little armed, protected areas with fences around them, away from their fields. I mean, and they would do by choppers. And in Vietnam society, a mother would never let a child go into a strange threshold first. They would go first. And the soldiers would say, okay, when they line up these kids, the same group, they would evacuate a village and they would say to the woman, no, children go first. And the woman would, not knowing English, would resist. And they would beat them with their rifle butts and say, look at these crazy women, want to go first, leaving the kids behind, not knowing the culture. And so how can you, there were as much victims in a way as those they killed.
So I'd stop you there. More from Zai Hirsch in this Going Underground special after the break. Welcome back. We're still here with Zai Hirsch, whose latest book, Reporter, a Memoir, is out now. In the past 48 hours, Israeli jets have targeted Damascus. I mean, the war seems to be continuing of a kind. You said that there are actually two suspects for the chemical attacks that news of which was beamed around the world as a reason why, say, Britain should bomb Syria. Why do you think many journalists would just say, no, there is only one suspect, the Assad government? And
well, what happened is you're talking about an incident in which the Syria, Bashar Assad's, used nerve agents against his own people in East Ghouta, East Ghouta took, that was in 2013. East Ghouta always was a very, from his point of view, reactionary force. They were always very hostile to his presidency. And of course, it was constant conflict. It was al-Nusra, one of the gangs, and ISIS later. It was a stronghold, as we all know now. It's bombed the smithereens. The war is awful. We Americans should maybe be a little more tolerant. I mean, the hatred for Bashar, he had a war, and it was an awful war, and he fought it awfully, but so do we. Everybody does. That's the horrible thing about wars, and they're not good.
British government is funding the white helmets right now that say it's one-sided here. It's the Syrian government that are committing the atrocities.
There's no question. I'm sure there are some people in the white helmets that were very actually doing what, trying to save lives. But it's pretty clear now that they're basically the major funding. Also, I think America was indirectly supplying some money. Certainly the Brits were. And so certainly it was a propaganda organization too, along with possibly doing some real good relief work. But too many times you've seen the same child in photographs, you know, year after year, always covered in dust. I mean, there's been a lot of actually good reporting on it, that they do engage in anti-Assad, but it's very easy here. Assad is hated. And I get a lot of criticism for saying, having a different story, for example, about the use of sarin. And I couldn't publish what I wanted about him in America. I had to publish it here in the London Review. Now, all that happens is, in June of 2013, there was a very important all-source intelligence report put out by the American Defense Intelligence Agency. It included, but made it complicated for me. I got a copy, leaked, I guess you call it. And it had a lot of signals intelligence. And the one reason I sort of stay alive, I don't want to cross up any intelligence operation that's reasonable, legitimate. There's a lot of stuff in this particular document. I didn't publish it because I didn't know how much of this stuff is very competent. We're doing us good, learning some stuff about the other side. I just didn't know. So what I had a report that said there was tremendous concern in the community because both Turkey, through their gendarmerie, their para-police units, were driving truckfuls of the chemicals that, when mixed together, make a nerve agent. It's called kitchen sarin. It's very crude. The Syrian army has a very sophisticated sarin that has additives that make it more lethal, more toxicity, a more penetration, much better weapon. In fact, it's so toxic, nerve agent, once you make it, you take an organophosphate and an alcohol. I mean, certain specific kinds, you mix them, add the additives, you have to put it in a weapon because it'll burn through a weapon in a day, even a concrete steel weapon. So it's use it or lose it. If you meld it, and so we and the Israelis used to monitor the Syrian chemical arsenals, and we could, for once we detected them melding it, that we were going to attack. And Israel was in this with us too. So Israel knows the rest of the story I'm telling you. And we also knew then the Syrian army had a very sophisticated weapon. And we also knew from this intelligence report that Saudi Arabia and Turkey were supplying the basic chemicals to al-Nusra, which ISIS wasn't there then. Al-Nusra was the cutting edge. And so there was
linked to al-Qaeda.
Tremendous, yes. Well, absolutely linked to al-Qaeda. We always link everything to al-Qaeda because there was a law passed in 2002 after the invasion that said anytime al-Qaeda is involved, the president can do what he wants without Congress. So we always call everything al-Qaeda. I mean, everything around in Libya was al-Qaeda. Throughout Africa, we use al-Qaeda because that gives you the cover of the law. Congress passed that stupid act, giving Bush the right to intervene anywhere without going in congressional authorization. It's an amazing piece of legislation. Talk about dumb. Anyway, the point is, this report troubled everybody. There was a study done about what can we do about it. How many people, American soldiers, we didn't want al-Nusra to have nerve agents. Suddenly comes this attack, and we get a sample from the Russians, and it's taken to Sir Peter Wall, who's the director general, the head of the British military. The sample is taken to his people.
Porton Down, yeah.
They go take it to Porton Down, where they conclude, we know what the Syria has. Syria's been a signatory to the Geneva Convention on Chemical Weapons. We know what Syria has. We know what it looks like. And what was used in that place was not the same as in the Syrian military. This is told to Obama two times by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs before. The reason he didn't bomb, remember the red line, when the attack took place. So when the attack took place at allegedly 1,400, was one-tenth as many, it doesn't matter. When the attack took place and people were killed and the world said Bashar Assad did it, my government said that, the government knew. They knew from this very important intelligence report that caused a huge study to be done inside about what to do about it. It would take 60,000 troops to get into the war. We were thinking of maybe sending troops on the side of Bashar, really, to get rid of this stuff. We didn't want these guys to have it. And of course, that was too many troops and it didn't happen. But they knew there were two suspects that knew al-Nusra had the stuff and Syria had the stuff. Forget about having it analyzed. They knew right away, and they only talked about one. And so I wrote an article saying, wow, let's hold on, folks. And what I also learned, because I was writing months later, is that the material that was taken by Russian intelligence, which is quite, what can I tell you, Russian intelligence in Damascus, I mean, without Russia, I don't think he could have survived. I think they saved him. A couple of years, in 15, he was in trouble. He might have survived anyway. The army was holding forth. It wasn't collapsing as much as people thought, but he was having trouble with Bashar Assad. Anyway, and by the way, I'm always taken as an apologist for Bashar Assad. All I'm doing is telling truth. I'm telling facts, period. People who fight wars all fight the same way. He doesn't do anything differently than we do. We bomb the hell out of people. How can the United States, who used the nuclear bomb in Hiroshima and did daylight bombing of major cities in Germany, 1944 cities, you know, the famous bombings that everybody, Dresden, just firestorms. Who are we to say somebody else is a war criminal for fighting the war? He was in a war, a guerrilla war. And by all accounts, the casualties were almost the same on both sides. If this is an apology, that's just people not wanting to believe their dislike, letting their personal dislike overcome reality. The point is that it was analyzed in Porton Downs. The Brits had it analyzed, which is a laboratory we in America respect for their skill in chemical weapons. It was delivered, the account was delivered to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. His name was Norman Dempsey. Dempsey takes it. I write this categorically in the London Review. I write this. I don't say who the source is, but I say he takes it. You don't hear him denying it. You hear nothing said about this. Takes it to the president and says, Mr. President, you can't bomb. You don't have a case. It's not clear. It's not clear Bashar did it. The same day we learned later, years later in 2015, Obama does a long interview with a man named Jeffrey Goldberg of Atlantic Monthly magazine, one of his people he liked a lot. 20,000 word interview. In the middle of the interview, he says about that incident, the red line, the head of national intelligence, a general named Clapper, Air Force General, comes to see me and he says, Mr. President, it's not a slam dunk, which is, you know, like they consider to be
Libya, perhaps. No, it's not.
So he didn't do the bombing because he didn't think he could win the case in the public arena. That's why he didn't do the bombing, not because there was a deal made on getting rid of weapons. He lied. And so I write this stuff. He didn't tell the truth. Syria wanted to get rid of this weapon. Bashar Assad wanted to, I wrote in 2003 for the New Yorker, quoting Mustafa Talas, the chief, the head of the defense he's defense minister of Syria, had been defense minister for 10, 20 years, wrote a lot of poetry, Mustafa. I quote him as saying, at one point there was a worry that America may attack Syria. And I said, what would you do then? He said, what could I do? And I said, well, you could use your chemical weapons. And the colloquy is in the New Yorker. And it was read to him, you know, the New Yorker check stuff. He approved this all. It was in English. He speaks English. And he said to me, he said, those things, chemical weapons, he says, those things, those useless things that the old man Bashar's father wanted, Hafez, he thought it was a deterrent against Israel, cost us a fortune. We have to protect them. It's a big pain. He said, if we use those weapons, America could incinerate us with nukes and they'd be right to. That's how crazy it would be to use those weapons. I said, what would you do then? And he said, well, we let the Americans come. Let they come to Damascus and let's see what happens. I said, what are you talking about? He said, just like in Baghdad, when the Knights of Malta came in the 13th century, the rivers would be full of their blood, he said. We'd have a resistance. And so I remember going back and telling my general friends in Washington, you know, this is not textbook. You know, you're talking about the defense minister. He's not going to defend the country. He's going to let you come and kill you when you get there. They're different. I remember saying, it's not going to be like the fight against Stalingrad. You're not going to have a defense, a perimeter, and you're going to have to fight your way into the city. He's going to let you in and get you when you're there. It was very interesting. But anyway,
the British Prime Minister here was telling us it is certain that British troops should be involved. We were getting huge amounts of persuasion here.
In Syria now?
On Syria until, say, a year ago.
But you know, but it's over now. The Kurds have cut a deal with Bashar Assad. It's over.
And then Trump seems to have changed his policies. Of course, when it comes to doubt, we've been having here a thing where Russia has been accused on a regular basis in the British Parliament of assassinating people in Britain.
That case is sort of falling apart. There's been some reporting from Europe. And
I should say the book says you start researching on WMD contexts for stories for decades now you've been...
Oh, yeah, I wrote a book about WMD.
Yeah.
For example, there was a story...
Let me just say this.
There was a story in the press where Syria was using chlorine in East Ghouta, in the end game at the ISIS in East Ghouta, you know, this spring. There was an end game. And there was a story that they were using sarin gas and chlorine together. And so here's...
White helmets had footage.
In the 50s, chlorine's a very volatile gas, and it's of great interest to the... It's not a warfare agent. And there was a story just the other day about Syria dropped a UN report claiming they dropped a chlorine gas bomb. There's no such thing in anybody's arsenal, a chlorine bomb. You'd have to, how much chlorine can you put into it? Chlorine is a gas that dissipates quickly. It moves quickly. It's not lethal. You can breathe it and keep on. It's not a warfare agent. There's no such bomb. But even more important, because chlorine is so reactive, in the chemical corps in America, when they developed these nerve agents in the 50s, they thought, let's see what happens if we meld chlorine with it. Maybe we would soup it up, make it even more efficient as a killer. And it turned out that chlorine immediately, the first thing it did, and there's field reports, this is published documents in the field, chlorine immediately would go and grab all the hydrogen molecules from the sarin, denuding the sarin. So it worked exactly the opposite. In other words, sarin dropped with chlorine, sarin would become just another useless gas. It would be much less lethal. The chlorine would make it weak. So that you can't...
Which isn't the way it was reported.
You can't use sarin and chlorine together. Just, okay, but nobody does any homework.
The Skripals, we had Jeffrey Robertson, QC, one of the world's leading human rights barristers on, who said that Russia has passed on this, killing Litvinenko here, the MI6 spy who was turned. We were told in this country, I mean, clearly this was a lethal military-grade nerve agent.
Yeah, it was a nerve gas, as if you wouldn't kill half the population. You have no idea. Military grade VX, you could wipe out half of London with one bomb. I mean, it's really...
I said it was Novichok, so it's...
Well, the story, the only thing... Look, I have written about it, so you're asking about something I haven't written. The story I always had about it from my friends in America is those two were helping the British intelligence services with information about the Russian mafia. That's what they were doing here. In other words, the people that would high on the list that would want to hurt them would be the Russian mafia. Russians, but not the Russian government.
Talking about the Skripals. Well.
Yeah. I mean, that was the understanding. And there's also been some reporting in Europe out of that that's been pretty much widespread. There was a story, but the same thing, that they were actually were doing work for the British intelligence community on mob activities. I mean, there is a big Russian mafia, let's face it. But that isn't the Russian government. All I would say is, I'm telling you what I was told, but I haven't done any reporting on it. So I don't know firsthand. I know secondhand, I've been told by people in America, because you ask about it, is that most likely, they were known to have been talking to the six and five, what, relevant six or five people at MI, five or six people, about what they knew about Russian corruption in Europe, not in Russia, the gang, the activities. And so the only, from there, you can draw your own conclusions about who wanted to hurt him.
Sai, thank you. That's it for the show. His book, Reporter of Memoir, is out now. That's it for the show. We'll be back on Monday. Till then, keep in touch via social media. We'll see you on Monday. 42 years to the day the Socialist Republic of Vietnam was reunified after losing millions of men, women, and children and defeating the United States of America.
Hello again and welcome. This week we continue talking to Seymour Hersh, writer, investigative journalist par excellence, who still manages to annoy people in high places. Hi. The other big story you did on Syria, saying that the sarin gas chemical warfare was not used by the government, but actually by the opposition to Assad, that really created mayhem. I mean, they went crazy.
Let me do the caveat. Okay. What I wrote was that the intelligence community from Intercepts knew that El Nusra had been given the precursors. Sarin is a gas, once mixed and created, yeah, it's toxic, and it can burn through even a shell in a day.
Yeah.
But when you mix it together with a certain chemical, you make this incredible potent agent that attacks the nervous system, and you within seconds, you're dead.
Just a drop can kill you. And I knew a lot about it because I'd written a book on chemical biological warfare. And so I knew long before August of this took place in Ghouta, East, a suburb of, Damascus still has troubles in this, the Jobar Gate. There's still, right outside of, there's still some bad spots in the suburbs. And they've been fighting a war against the rebels or the opposition for 5 years now.
Yes.
And, they haven't quite cleaned, they've done great. We'll talk about the Russian role in a minute, but there's still areas of pockets of resistance. And that was East Ghouta, where this attack took place, was a focal point of resistance. And there were a couple things about this. Well, all that happened is, and the story, I was very clear. I said that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dempsey, who Martin Dempsey was his name, turns out to be one of these army guys that went to West Point, then went in the army, and then over his career served at one point with Sir Peter Wall, who became the chief of the British military. He also was a tank commander in West Germany when his opposition tank commander was the man who's now the chief general of the Russian army. And they met 25, 30 years ago at social events in Berlin, and they would toast and say, when we get in power, we're gonna be better than these other guys. So there just happened to be three people who knew each other as professional officers from very early on. They served together, they were even in different services, they were in the same area at the same time and would colloquy. And so Dempsey, whose view of the president was that Obama made him chairman of the Joint Chief, but really didn't really know much about him. His feeling about Obama was Obama thought that anybody who spent his career in the military was sort of like, why do you want to deal with them? Obama's a judgmental guy.
Yeah.
And so he just kept his mouth, he just did what he wanted to do. And so the Russians came to him. The event took place on August the 21st, and on August the 30th, the president surprised everybody by announcing that even though what he called a red line, if there was evidence of sarin use, he was going to attack. A major attack was planned. After the French were involved, the British were involved. But the parliament said no. We had maybe 40 or 50 targets we were going to hit. I mean, serious targets, infrastructure, water treatment plants, et cetera. We were really going to bomb the hell out of the place. That was the target package, much bigger than they told the public. And at the last minute, he canceled it. That's what I wrote, because yes. Dempsey goes to see him and said, Sir Peter Wall had gotten some sarin from the site very early. From the site where 1,400 people allegedly were killed, and that number is a fiction. The most of it was 200. Look, one is too many. Nerve gas was used, a primitive form. He'd gotten some of the nerve gas right away. He'd taken it to Sir Peter Wall, who took it to Porton Downs, which is the chemical and biological laboratory we use. It's the standard laboratory. And they had samples of what was in the Syrian arsenal, because people forget that after 91 and the fall of Russia, there was a lot of comity. And Russians shared intelligence with us. We knew the sarin that the Syrian army would make was a different, higher level. It had additives in it. It had stuff that made it more persistent, more toxic. You know, a weapon to kill people in a war. And the problem you also had at that time was that the Syrian chemical warfare facilities, there were about 22 or 23 of them, had been built by Bashar Assad's father, Hafez, in the 80s. He thought this would be a deterrent against Israel with the border country. You know, there was always tension. But of course, Bashar's point of view was, you can't fight a nuclear bomb with a chemical. And so he didn't like the system. And they were very open. You could find 50 places between 2002 and 2011 where people inside Mustafa Talas, the head general, publicly saying these goddamn weapons are useless. And what did happen was when the war began, the civil war began, the opposition did seize a chemical. There were 23, 24 of them, did seize a depot in Idris, in the province above Aleppo, where there's still some fighting. Although I must say that situation's changed a lot.
Yeah.
And the Russians were stuck. The rebels always wanted to get to the arsenals, to get the chemicals. And the Russians were stuck helping the Syrians defend it. So the history is, Lavrov and Kerry, you have to remember the president explained not bombing by saying that at the last minute, The Syrians announced they were willing to agree that they announced they actually had chemical weapons and they were going to get rid of
them. Yeah.
And that's why he didn't bomb. It was a great deal. We got rid of the weapons at no cost. What the press doesn't do, God, I wish reporters would read before they write. That's all you have to do is read, because there's a written record. Lavrov and Kerry were speaking about the chemical arsenal, and they'd have meetings, and they would have a debriefing in Moscow, wherever they met in Europe. And one of the items would be, we talked about getting rid of the arsenal. And the problem was, Syria said, we got no money. And the Russians said, oil prices are falling. It's a billion plus, 1.2 billion it cost. That's a lot of money to get rid of an arsenal. You have to move it out, decontaminate it, get it done at sea. And we weren't going to pay. There was a G20 summit in Northern Ireland, and Putin and Bashar had June, 2 months before this incident, they had an hour meeting, and Ben Rhodes, who's the spokesman for the president, gave a briefing. That's in the White House, I think June 26th, you can go online and find it. And he said, among the things discussed, once again, we discussed the chemical warfare without any resolution. You know, we have to figure out some way to get rid of it. That's been a big topic of discussion. So Dempsey goes to Obama and says, we don't know what happened, but we know that what you did, look at it as a crime scene. There was a crime. There was a crime committed. Somebody used sarin. People were killed. What we did is, the only suspect we looked at was Syria, even though I knew that the American intelligence community had been reporting since the spring that al-Nusra had been given the precursor chemicals by also the Saudis coming in from Lebanon, and also by the Turks, who play a major role in supporting the opposition. It's a sort of special forces paramilitary police unit called the Gendarmerie. Mm-hmm. We track trucks coming in with this stuff, and we knew they had the precursors. So we knew they were capable of making it as early as April.
And Dempsey said this to Obama.
Well, there was intelligence all over the place. I don't know. All I know is what he said is, the case doesn't make it. And Obama then takes a walk, and he calls off the raid, and he announces he did so because of this deal. And everybody said, Syria caveat. And that didn't make sense, because I knew the history. They'd been talking about it forever. And Syria can't pay, and Russia said, we can't pay. What happened is, of course, we agreed to pay. That's what changed everything. And an American ship was involved, and the Americans were deeply involved in the whole process. We decontaminated. We spent about $1 billion. We put up $1 billion of the $1.2 billion. There's something called the Chemical Warfare Treaty. Under the treaty, it was, and also the UN was involved. It's all budget stuff is available. If you do the work, I didn't even think I had to say this in the article. We got rid of it. It was our ship. We took a merchant marine ship, and we spent, and we did I don't know how much it cost. We fitted it into two big containers for decontamination. And it was very complicated, because the Syrians wouldn't let the American ship into international their waters. They had to stay out in the middle of the Med, out in Latakia, where the Russian port is, and the Syrian port is on the Med. And Syria itself moved the stuff, 1,308 tons from 22 depots or 23 depots. They moved it to the port. It took a lot of time, because at that time, around Latakia, it was before the Russians got there, they were still in Nusra. The Syrians were very worried that a bomb would come, or a mortar would hit a convoy and spread this crazy stuff. So they took their time doing it, while the American public is being told Syrians are dragging their feet, maybe it's not gonna work. And of course the UN knew they were just being careful. They put it on a Danish ship and a Danish ship and a Norwegian ship, took the stuff from the port to the American ship. The American ship decontaminated. When they got all the, and they also saw, well, here's what else I know that I didn't write. About 3 weeks ago, there was a big story in the Atlantic magazine. Obama gave an interview to a reporter named Jeff Goldberg.
I saw that.
Huge story, 20,000 words. And the whole premise of Goldberg's story was that Obama had gone to the red line, that the Syrians had killed 1,400 people, never mind that the French, all these different medical groups had gone in and said it was much fewer people. Again, if one is dead, one is too many. But Goldberg writes the story all about how he didn't do what's with Obama. You know, Goldberg's sort of a hawk, and why didn't he do it? And it was all about that. And in the middle of this 20,000-word tedious that I read very carefully, because at one point I said, I better read it all, because Obama's giving him briefings and talking constantly. He writes that without sourcing it, but it's in a passage where Obama's talking. And he said, well, there was one problem, was the head of intelligence, General Dempsey, the general I mean, Martin Dempsey, was chairman of the Joint Chiefs, but he's not he's a military guy. That we have an intelligence system was headed by the Office of National Intelligence. It's headed by a retired Air Force general named Clapper. So in the story, he says, well, there was a problem because Clapper had came pretty early after the event and said to the president, it's not a slam dunk. And slam dunk was a word that was used by the head of the CIA, George Tenet, to tell George Bush and Dick Cheney that there were WMDs. The intelligence is great. So slam dunk is a real inside word. It means we don't got it. Yeah. It's not a slam dunk. And that was a problem for the president. So the president learned from the general in charge of intelligence that we can't make the case. If we had to go to a court, we can't prove that the sarin was anything other than an off brand. It wasn't the sarin known to be in the arsenal. And that day, the day of a week later, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, coming from a different point of view, I don't know what Clapper's intelligence basis was, but I know what Dempsey's was, says to the president, you can't, there's going to be hearings on this, and if I have to testify, I'm going to tell the truth, is what he said. Mm. So he tells the American people that I didn't do it because the Syrians capitulated, and they're going to they're going to give up their weapons, and this is a great coup. And here's what I don't like about it. He is willing to let the world believe that Bashar used nerve gas on his own people at a time when inspectors were there coming to inspect the earlier incidents, when he knew that it wasn't true. He didn't know, it's possible Bashar could have, a rogue group did something, but he knew there was no evidence. He let that blood libel stay, and he still has it stay. And even though it's for some reason he mentioned the Clapper thing, the Goldberg, he didn't object to the story that said 1,400 were killed. And I'll tell you what I've learned since, that we were responsible. The ship that we used was called the Cape May. And by the way, for the United States to pay UN costs like that is not unusual. We often don't contribute our share, we get yelled at, but we pay, for example, if a peacekeeping group is going to the border of Lebanon and Israel from Biafra, we fly them. We have covert airlines that fly them. So we pay a lot of money to the UN in this kind of stuff, a moving thing. So it's not unusual to put $1 billion investment into that. But of course, the big issue for us is, what can we prove about Bashar? So on the ship is called the Cape May. When the stuff came in, they came in rockets. It came in containers. It came to be contaminated. It came in bulk. Horrible stuff to deal with, leaking. We had a forensic analysis team there. And what are they doing? They're studying the hell out of that stuff coming from the Syrian arsenal, because they have the whole profile of the sarin that was found, and they don't match. No DNA match. And they also had it long enough that they could watch the decomposure. They had it we couldn't find a port that would let us drop it anywhere. We had to dump it in the middle of the Med. 10,000 people protested in Crete and other islands. The American press didn't report any of it. We were dumping this decontaminated stuff. It was like, I don't know if you know what Drano is. It's stuff it wouldn't kill you, but the sludge was like Drano. It was toxic. We're dumping, it goes up, if there's 1,308 tons, you add about 20, when you add hot water and a certain sulfuric acid to decontaminate it, you make it 20 times greater in bulk. That kind of stuff, we dumped it off the tip of Italy. We went to a mafia base and had to pay a lot of money to the mafia port to unload it. Anyway, it's another mess. But so we know after the fact, even, we don't tell the truth. It's just amazing to me. And here's this story, this blood libel that he lets go. And today, what's the American position? Bashar must go. Bashar, in America, the only thing worse than saying something civil about, not, or saying something to suggest that maybe he's no worse than any other of the monsters that live in the Gulf world, you know, who are despots, is saying something nice about Russia. Those two things you can't say.
But Syed, the other aspect of it is that the President of the United States announces this is a red line. If you cross it, we're coming in. He says it publicly. The people listening to it, of course, are the people fighting Bashar Assad. mean, either some rogue element who wants to provoke a U.S. intervention or someone who says it's the only way we can defeat Assad is with the American army, feet on the ground there. I mean, why is it such a crazy idea that a false flag operation would be carried out to draw the Americans in?
What I also wrote in that article in the London Review was that we do have the ability to spy communications. We have a team that's, I'm not telling the Turks something they don't know. There's actually formal MOUs, memorandum of understanding about this stuff. You know, Turk is a NATO ally. And, you know, Erdogan's completely lost it. He's completely crazy. He's getting crazier every day. And he's, arresting the press and in trouble.
No, it's a madness. Repressing
and they're
Kurds,
killing, what they're doing to the PKK now, his gendarmerie.
Appalling. Yeah.
Appalling. And let's just face it, and we can't say that either.
No.
That he's gone completely off the...
Say that from the States. The Europeans can't say that because they're giving him money to take the refugees back.
And also because he's been supporting ISIS and supporting al-Nusra. The border's been open, Hatay province. We have communication intelligence. And so here's what happens. We don't know who did what. We know there's something wrong with the story. And we listen to things. And they were very quiet. You don't hear anything. The day after the raid, when the United States, here's how the United States found, went public with the word 1400. We took, there was, when the incident took place, there's iPhones, and there were iPhone photographs of dead, of people that seemed to be dead, that we all assume were actually from that incident. And we know there's a lot of faking going on, but nonetheless, they took six or seven of the pictures of groups of dead people, and they computed the area. And they computed how many people were in that area. And then they extrapolated how big the whole area was. And that's how they got to 1,400. The number was completely a made-up number. You had to walk into the stuff. It wasn't that toxic. You had to walk into it. If you were next to it, you felt sick and you recovered in a couple of weeks. You had lung trouble, but you could survive. You had to walk into it before you died, basically. And there were UN inspectors there. There was a team coming that had arrived 2 days earlier to talk about the earlier events that took place. Anyway, so... So what happened is after the event, when the world went nuts about 3 days later saying, oh my God, Bashar killed all of his own people, the communication system in Turkey, the military and intelligence people began going, hey, congratulations, you guys did a great job. That's what we picked up. And that is very often. What you do in the NSA is you always listen after an event when you don't know what happened. And so from there, you can construct a very plausible scenario given the extreme amount from cabinet level to cabinet level of the military that clearly at least they perceived that they had a role in the role. And so you had exactly as you say, that it was a false flag operation. That doesn't mean, if I had a bet, I would say the Turkish precursors made it and not the Saudis. There's also something that happened that was amazing to me. In the reporting, the White House, and I said that you have evidence, there were reports done in, we're going to the White House and asking for comment, you know, which I think it's become so useless now. I said, there are intelligence reports I named two or three in May and June that went to a certain officer. I named the officer. It was an all source thing, satellite intercepts Israelis who are very big in Syria because of course that's a neighbor. And Israelis have been very quiet about Bashar. They don't scream as much about him because they know it's either Bashar or ISIS. And they can deal with Bashar as much as they profess not to like him. And I'm sure they don't. But anyway, so I go to the White House with say there's evidence that you guys, major reports. And one fact, at one time a study was done about how many troops would it take to go and attack every al-Nusra facility that has nerve chemicals and take the chemicals away. They did a workup at the JCS. The same general, Martin Dempsey, was involved in this workup. He authorized it. 70,000 people it would take to go wipe out the arsenal that was there, the chemicals we knew to exist. We really didn't want those people to have the chemicals. The White House says, no way, no way, not true, no such documents. So I go to somebody inside. I rarely have done this. In fact, first time I did it in 10 years. And I said, you have to do me a favor. He's given me a summary. He's given me a sanitized, a PDF. He's given me a the whole document without any markings on it, through a scanner. You know, scanners change things. They change the physicality of things. So through a scanner and PDF, I have the document. By the way, there's also a great annex about something called the chemical market in Baghdad, where you can buy nerve gas and mustard gas. You can buy anything in Baghdad, any weapon you want. I mean, it's amazing what's going on there, but nonetheless. And so I go to my friend and I said, can you give me the markings on it? They have a series of, in the Foreign Office emails, they have a series of dots, dashes, and funny little symbols to make it hard to copy. And these reports that I was getting come from a very sophisticated system that collects signals intelligence. And so my friend went, and if there was 20 digits, he gave me 16 of them. The last four would be enough to indicate what computer it came out of, and then he'd be in trouble. So I took that to the White House. And this time, their answer was, get this, this is the spokesman, a foreign service officer whose job is to help the press, right? I have the email, and what this woman wrote, and she's a senior, she worked in Baghdad. She said, well, I'm not saying there's no document like that. I'm not gonna say that. What I am gonna say, that it wasn't well done, and it wasn't taken very seriously here, so it just didn't get much credibility. How's that for an answer? And you say to yourself, their job is to report, to help the press. It's just bankrupt, it's gone. It's a bankrupt system. And the important thing about that is it helped feed this. Bashar's not a great guy, he's in a war. Terrible things happen in war when you're fighting a group like ISIS or that beheads your soldiers. There's they have video of hundreds of soldiers being executed. It was an awful war. Bashar's in a life and death situation. If the other side guy wins, he's gone. His throat's cut, his children's throats are cut. They're hung out in a square like Mussolini. Everybody says he's using barrel bombs, and I keep on thinking, well, if he used the 500-pound bomb, would that be better? I don't quite understand with the distinction that we're making. Russia did a fantastic job. They came in and they not only did the bombing, they took the various Syrian armies, particularly the fourth that had been in bad shape, they took them out of commission. And then they began to retrain them, and then they resupplied them. They made the armies better. Hezbollah came, and they said to the army, no, we're going to show you how to win a war. You don't do what the Americans and other Western armies do. You don't go to a city and then begin to bomb it. And after it's all bombed to death, you walk in. You go in and you fight hand to hand. As happened, by the way, in Palmyra. Palmyra was very ugly. There was very intense fighting, and the Syrian army lost a lot. The Russians had commandos there in the mountain, the foothills above, hand to hand fighting. It was a lot worse, tougher war than you think. Mm. And it was a great victory for Bashar's army. Because Raqqa's next, maybe. You know, I think the Kurds want to go there, I would guess that Bashar is in much better shape. The talks in Geneva never had a chance because the other side always insisted he couldn't stand for election. So it's over, the war's back.
Sai, let's move to your own country. We're in the middle of an election campaign. I mean, it's a horrendous choice for a country like the United States. I mean, I can't think of such a bad choice, certainly not in the 20th century.
Well, the way I look at it, my father came from Lithuania, where the Germans really did a good job on the Jews, the Jew out of Lithuania. But I'm probably thinking about see if I can get citizenship, maybe get an alternative plan. I mean, we're making all these jokes about Canada. You know, the Canadians are making a lot of jokes. We're sorry, we don't want you. We know you want to come here now. It's a pretty grim picture.
Yeah.
It's a pretty grim picture. But the Democratic Party ought to listen to what's happening with Sanders. You know, Sanders is like me, a cranky old man. You know, you don't say this because in America you can't say this, but I will tell you what's totally astonishing about him. He's the first, I'm 79, he's the first Democratic candidate since I've been old enough to follow politics who didn't have to go to the New York Jews for money. First one to have to go beg any hand. So, and he also spoke openly in a debate the other week. They asked him about his support in Brooklyn, to say that we have to treat the Palestinians like human beings.
It was amazing to hear.
Was it amazing? And he didn't get enough credit for the integrity of saying that.
Yeah.
And because I actually think the younger Jews don't buy into the Israeli game anymore.
What is the new president Clinton going to do if she wins?
It's not change.
Nothing will change.
That's a what if question. I don't know.
Yeah.
I would say certainly. I very much doubt if there's going to be some hallelujah. Kumbaya. I mean, no. She's not going to make a. She's not going to go to the Russians. You know, I know smart guys inside, and you spend 20 years going from nothing to a two-star general, and this is a great thing for you. You know, the wonderful thing. And the bad thing about America is that Tocqueville wrote about it when he wrote about America in, 180 years ago. He said, well, the interesting thing about America is in England, he said, the military comes from royalty. You're born and you're going to be the leader of this particular troop. You know, that's how it is, the Duke of whatever. In America, one path to success from the lower caste to the upper class
is the army.
And that means, in order to make it in the army, you have to have wars. That means America's going to be a very warlike country. He said you could predict wars constantly. They're going to be very aggressive because it's a path, it's a social path up, one of the few they have. We don't have that, and there's no reason for us to be so militaristic because every general knows he's going to be general from the moment he's born. Sort of interesting point he made.
Your profession has changed a lot.
Yes. I do understand there's something new in the business now, and it's very interesting. There's startups that are like BuzzFeed,
yeah,
and even Huffington Post. There's startups that have news and they have wide readership. And most of the, I guarantee 95% of the kids who support Bernie get their news not from the New York Times.
No,
get it online.
Absolutely. It's the same here. Yeah. I mean, this whole concept of embedded journalism, is a sign of the times. It's not just embedded during wartime. It's embedded here.
I talk to people that were embedded, and here's what happened. What happens is you're embedded with a Marine division when you, and this has happened first in 2001 when the first Gulf War.
Yeah.
And that was the first time they did embedding to that extent. And you're with a group of American Marines in a tank. And we're pretty nice guys. You know, we're friendly and we're open. And the second day of the war, one person told me this. They're coming from Kuwait, and by the second day they've already rolled past Ramadi. They're getting close to Baghdad. They've gone 50 or 100 miles into Baghdad, into Iraq, and they're at a crossroad, and there's a bunch of cars there, and they yell, "Hey, get out of here, you guys! No cars coming on this crossroad. Why we're coming?" And they wouldn't stop. Cars were driving along with them, and they yelled at them, and they pointed their guns, and they said, "Hey, you guys, stop!" As if everybody knows English. And so, at some point, somebody opened up and killed a bunch of kids in cars. It was the second day when somebody said they just shot the car up. One of the gunners just shot him up, a heavy caliber machine gun. Doesn't take, a few minutes. And it was all kids and women, and they were just horrified. He didn't write it.
He didn't write.
No, because these are good kids. That's embedding. And it keeps you from doing your job.
Si, it's been great talking to you. We could go on all night and all day tomorrow, but we've got to stop somewhere. Thanks very much. A very real pleasure.